All right, we're looking at a political philosophy of Rousseau. Rousseau was born in Geneva, Switzerland in 1712, and he was reared in what was left of the Calvinistic tradition of Geneva. He left Geneva with many of these influences behind him, and during his travels, he was influenced by various persons and places. Rousseau held to a natural equality in the state of nature. To prove the existence of the natural equality of man, Rousseau, in a direct criticism of Locke and Hobbes, comments, and I quote, "The philosophers who have inquired into the foundation of society have all felt the necessity of going to the state of nature, but not one of them has gotten there." Unquote. You see, he's going to address the very same problem. The problem is one of how we view man. It's going to be the same problem all through your political theory studies. In that, when you view man, you come back to a question of authority and liberty. Rousseau points out that in history there are two kinds of inequality. First, there is an inequality of age, health, bodily strength, and in mind and soul. And secondly, there is an inequality of moral and political natures. This is characteristic of man after he enters into what he calls the contractual relationship, and he talks about the social contract to be governed by political authority. Upon these two premises, Rousseau builds an evolution of man in the state of nature. Here we find two discernible stages, according to Rousseau, concerning man's development. First, he says, man is at the direct appropriation or gathering stage. That is the stage in which he's going to enter into a social contract. This is the most primitive stage and involves many inequalities. The most outstanding being those of personal strength and ability. However, man is endowed with two redeeming virtues, even though he has all these inequalities. First, the ability to learn by experience. He's a good empiricist. And secondly, the virtue of the heart, such as love and understanding. The second stage of this development, evolutionary, is called the agricultural stage, in which man settles down into hunting, fishing, and the domestication of plants and animals. It is at this stage he learns to live with his fellow man in peace and harmony. Since there is enough food and land for all, they practice a type of communal existence with no concept of private property. All things are held in common. It is at this stage that Rousseau holds that man has come to the closest state of natural equality when he is able to live among his fellow men and he is able to live at peace with them. Now understand what he's saying. True equality among men is not in the individual. Natural equality is not in anything that the man necessarily does, but it's rather when all men live communally and there is no private property. There is no private possession. When men do not own anything of substance, but all hold to a communal ownership, that's equality. Now all men are equal. All they're different in abilities. Maybe one hunts better than the other, or one fishes better than the other, or one plants better than the other, or one is a better animal husbandry fellow than the other. But none of them own anything of their own. They all belong to the communal system. That's the equality. Now that
freaks of socialism, without question. I don't know if you could identify that or not. I think you've got a good idea of where Karl Marx will fit into all this, because Hegel bought heavily into Rousseau's position. And, of course, Hegel was the influence in Karl Marx. So, in essence, what you have is you have a common natural quality among all men. No private property. As a matter of fact, you'll see that he faults private property as being one of the downfalls in any society. Rousseau holds that the third stage is the problem of the development of inequality. This stage is called private property. This is the evil that prevails among men. Private property is theft. Why? Because it's supposed to be property held in common by all, so that all are equal. I believe someone, somewhere in our government at some time, read Rousseau. Because I believe they've come to that same conclusion. And so they're taxing the heck out of us for our property, and they're telling us, you don't own it. It's under the dominion of the sovereign of the government, and you only are allowed to possess it as long as you pay your tax on it. Otherwise, we'll take it back from you. It's a privilege. That's right. And it's not private property. It's not private property. Ultimately, then, private property is evil and is a corrupter of natural morality, he says. That is also responsible for social inequalities. You see, the problem is, Rousseau would say, there are the haves and the have-nots. Those that have, they may have worked hard for it, and they may have collected it, and they may have earned it by the sweat of their brow, and they did everything they can do. And then you have those who are lazy who have not. You see, it causes a social inequality. So what we do is we take from those who have and give to those who have not. Now that's the ideology behind the progressive income tax system. We're going to displace all the money and keep everybody on the same level. Poor! That's the thinking behind all of it. This man has had a major influence into our society. I don't remember a president with his last name, but I think he was in disguise. But in essence, this is what we have. This is the problem of inequality. It's property rights. The right that people can own certain things. If you want people to be happy, make them all equal. Those who don't work, feed them. Take care of them. Baby them. Because they have as many rights as the other individual does. Because nobody holds anything in common. It doesn't matter. When he comes to his views of political economy, he says to establish the idea of the political economy, he feels it is necessary to destroy the analogy of the family and the state. Now, many political theorists during this time period, particularly the 17th century, these political philosophers, such as Sir Robert Filmer of England, held that the state was merely a family relationship in which the monarch was a kind of a father and the subjects his children. To have accepted this concept of government would have been to deny the whole contractual basis of government and the natural rights of men. Thus, public economy would be impossible on the basis of a monarchical system. And so Rousseau said, no, government is not like a family system. It is like a contract, which all men must enter into that contract. Thus, according to Rousseau, the people are the sovereign, not the king. The government must be merely a tool of the people, nothing more. And the financial policies must be placed in the hands of the collective will of the people. This he called the general will. Hence, Rousseau is seeking to contract or to corporate a basis for his society in which all the people form an indivisible whole. He's trying to establish a government as a corporation,
a corporate entity. And everybody is a part of the corporation. And finally, Rousseau, in his views on political economy, says that he held that if public finances are to be controlled by the people through the general will, they must be based upon the same equality as that found in the state of nature. Hence, Rousseau holds that the social system of France led to an unequal class system rooted in private property and the uneven distribution of economic goods. To Rousseau, the well-being of all citizens, the general well that he's referring to, demanded that taxes be shared on the basis of ability to pay rather than inherited rank and social position. He suggested a more democratic tax structure to take this burden from the impoverished masses. As in France, the aristocrats and clergies were free from all forms of taxation, and only the lower class were bound to taxation. Thus, Rousseau wrote, and I quote, "He who has only necessities should not be taxed at all. Superfluities should be supertaxed. There should be heavy impost on every sort of luxury." Unquote. That was his way of taxing the rich and all of their luxuries. And so his answer was, we need to have an income tax that is progressive. A certain amount being taken. Those who have less, take less tax from them. Those who have more, you take more from them. And it just goes right up the list. The more they have, the more you tax them. It's progressive. It's just like our tax system in this country. It is a progressive system. If you make this much money, you have this much tax liability. If you make more and you move up into the next bracket and you're fortunate enough to move up to the next bracket, they take more from you. And it goes up and it goes up and it goes up. And it holds you within a certain classification. You see, we're supposed to be a country without classification of people. But we have it with the IRS. You know, that's the only way you determine middle class, low class, high class, no class. Ah, bureaucrats. But that's the classification system. And that's how they're classified in the United States. We're no different than India. They wear little red dots. We wear Social Security numbers. And our Social Security numbers have monetary values behind them. Ah, low class individual and no class individual. Well, we know who they are. So we need to structure the tax differently. Important part of developing any government. And that was the position he held to. Remember, the French Revolution came on the theoretical thinking of Rousseau. The revolution was socialistic to the hilt, and its purpose was to overthrow that system of authority which was above everyone else, that aristocratic society in France. And without question, the aristocratic society in France had its problems and its sins, as any government does when it isn't properly structured. But he abused, or if you will, he overthrew one abusive system and replaced it simply with another. He did not solve the problem of abuse. He simply said, let's change it for a while. Instead of the aristocrats ruling, we'll have the poor people, throw them all out, kill them, put them to death, put them in the prisons. We'll rule, and eventually you have a socialism develop, and out of that socialism comes a totalitarian group, and you're back to the same problem of oppression and tyranny. It never changes. We're just throwing out the different groups and putting in new groups to change the tyranny. Let's oppress them for a while. Next year we'll allow them to oppress us and move on down the line. It just doesn't change. And if you look at history somewhat, it seems almost kind of funny in a way because that's all they ever do is they simply exchange one type of oppression for another and just redirect it to some other people. And usually it ends up coming back around, you know. Perhaps maybe that's where the term what goes around comes around. I don't know. But a good place to put it in political arena. So anyway, we need to do this with the taxation. Now, concerning the social contract of Rousseau's political philosophy, Rousseau stated, man is born free, yet everywhere he is in chains. Rousseau began his search for the legitimate form of political organization for man with the structure of the need of how to justify man's transition from his natural freedom from the state of nature to the submission of the authority that is imposed upon him by the state. How does man, who is free, natural, sovereign individual, how does he become the subject of an authoritative government without losing his freedom? That's the question. How does he remain sovereign and yet grant sovereignty to a governmental system which is going to rule him? Well, you see, you have still the same problem as you have in any democracy. You still have the problem of authority versus liberty. They're not erasing the problem. They just keep giving different ways of trying to restructure it. They never resolve the problem. And he will not resolve it, and we'll see that. In essence, Rousseau must build a new civil or political society that will both retain the best interest of men as they were in the state of nature and further add values that only a political organization can give, and a man must submit himself thereunto. Now, let me say what the social contract that these men are entering into is not, because that's what's important. You see, they're coming out of the state of nature, and they're coming into this state of contract, where they're agreeing to enter into a system, a contract, in which they're going to give an authority to someone to rule. And he's got to solve the dilemma of how they come out and they're sovereign and enter into a contract and remain sovereign and yet at the same time grant sovereign authority. Got a real problem to answer there. But this is what the social contract is not. Okay, the social contract first is not to delineate a legitimate government that will represent all the people. Rousseau first analyzed several categories that can never be the basis for a just political order. First, he says, a patriarchal authority can never be the basis for a governmental system. The right of the strongest could never be the motive or the basis for a governmental system. Slavery cannot be the basis of a governmental system. And the divine right monarchy can never be the basis of any governmental system that will both protect the sovereignty of the individual and yet have the right of sovereignty rule in the state. And so you see, he has a major problem to deal with. And he says, well, it's clear that slavery is not the answer. Patriarchal authority is not the answer. The right of the strongest is not the answer. Divine right monarchy is not the answer. So what is the answer? And what is the social contract, therefore? After rejecting the patriarchal form of government, the divine right of monarchy, slavery, and the right of the strongest, as illegitimate forms of government, Rousseau turns to the social contract as the only proper means for man's entry into the political organization. And this is what he says. Rousseau wrote, and I quote, "The problem is to find a form of association which will defend and protect with the whole common force of the person and goods of each associate, and in which each, while uniting himself with all, may still obey himself alone and remain as free as before." Unquote. Now, I don't know if you got that, but in essence he said, we're going to show you how A is going to become A and not A at the same time. I'm going to show you the law of non-contradiction, how it will not work, will work. What it's supposed to be able to do decisively is not going to be able to do. I'm going to have man sovereign, and yet at the same time I'm going to have him not sovereign. That's what he said he's going to do. I'm going to make man sovereign and not sovereign at the same time. I'm going to have him enter into a contract of unity and grant sovereignty to a governmental position, and at the same time reserve all the rights he had before he entered into the contract. That's amazing. And if he can do it, he ought to be president. The form of the contract concept held by Rousseau is closer to and adopts the concepts of John Locke. The contract is between the people and the people, and not between a ruler and the ruled. The people contract for legitimate rule, not to mitigate the control of previously established authority. This latter view of the contract had been the second stage in its development, which had been influenced by the desire of the rising middle class to check the growth of the absolute monarchy. So this was a desiring growth, and he's seen this happening. And he says, we have got to check the whole system of monarchical reign. Rousseau did differ, though, from both Hobbes and Locke in some respects. For example, in the social contract, man is not viewed as moral until he enters the contract and becomes an effective part of the general will. Morality comes with the embodiment of the contract and the general will. Thus, the social contract seeks to bring man from an amoral isolation to a moral participation in the affairs of the community. So, in other words, morality only deals with man in relationship to other man, and not with man in relationship necessarily to God, per se. For the right of man as sovereign is to make his own law. And therefore, if he is his own law, every action he does cannot be moral or immoral. It must be amoral. The problem for Rousseau is to demonstrate the emergence of the general will. He must show how that man can give up natural freedom to the collective will of all, yet still retain his freedom. This is a fundamental problem which he does not demonstrate ever in his writings. He says, that's what I've got to do, and he never does it. Had a good answer, didn't he? He does not, and he can't, because it's impossible. You cannot take an individual who is declared to be sovereign and then turn around and say, I'm going to give to this ruling authority, I'm going to give him sovereignty to rule over all the sovereigns and then maintain the rights of the sovereigns over against the authority of the sovereign. This can't be done. It's a contradiction. It's a logical contradiction. He's never going to resolve it. And the problem is you can't have two sovereigns. You've got an impasse. Nothing can be resolved. Nothing can be done. That is a problem. That's the problem we're facing even today in many of our movements. We hear people talking about, oh, we're sovereign, and we can go into the courtroom of the other sovereign and tell him, you can't do anything to us because we're sovereign and you can't touch us. Now, that sounds good until you're thrown in jail. And you find out that you weren't as sovereign as you thought you were. And I know that they're not as sovereign as they claim they are, because neither one of them possess the right of sovereignty. We talked about political sovereignty. And all you have here is the old Mexican standoff, and eventually one of the two is going to kill one of the other to prove one of them sovereign. You see, that's a problem. You cannot. This will never work. I don't care what system. It will never work. Eventually, one will turn against the other. And one will become oppressive, and one will become the oppressed. On the one hand, you'll have either total anarchy when it's over with, or on the other hand, you have total tyranny. There just is no safe stopping point between this system when you hold to these two positions. The sovereignty of the individual and the sovereignty of the state. There's no stopping point. There's no middle ground. It is an either-or position, as Soren Kierkegaard said. And that's exactly what you have. On the one hand, man's personal freedom is given to no one, he said. And yet, on the other hand, the general will can force a man to obey the general will by force, if necessary. On the one hand, the man doesn't give up any rights. But on the other hand, the general will has the right to force him to obey.
You talk about contradiction. I think, as a Frenchman, he was just drunk, personally. I think he'd gotten all the good wine, and that's the best thing you come up with. it must have been great wine, because that's about all he's got. Can you imagine? A man gives up no rights, but at the same time he turns around and says, but he can be made by force to obey the general will, which is against his right. We might state the problem of Rousseau like this. How does man give authority to the social contract to form a part of the general will and yet retain sovereignty? Thus, we must turn to the issue of sovereignty to see if this area will yield an answer to the problem. Well, what's Rousseau's view of political sovereignty? The change of sovereignty from the ruler to the people received its initial impetus from the idea of natural law and natural rights, that man is entitled to life, liberty, and happiness in the political organization. Rousseau held to sovereignty in its simplest form. This consisted, basically, he said, of two elements. It is the power, and he uses that word very strong emphasis there on the word power. It is the power of the general will expressed in the common good of the entire community, as opposed to the vested interest of particular groups or individuals. What is sovereignty? Sovereignty is for the political organization, it is the power of the general will expressed for the common good of the entire community. Well, that sounds really nice, doesn't it? And if you got some particular interest groups out there, well, that's just too bad. Or any individuals out there, that's just too bad. We don't care what your special interest is or what you think your individualism is. The general will must prevail. But you have your rights to be as free as you were before you entered into this contract. The doctrine of popular sovereignty, so often referred to and identified with Rousseau, is what teaches us that ultimate power resides in the people. The general will is the people. It is the individuals collectively contracting to give authority to this body politic. And yet at the same time, he says each man has the right to his own sovereignty. Thus, to say that sovereignty is the power of the general will expressed in the interest of the common good of all may involve the acceptance of the fact that it may alienate the rights of the individual and private groups. Thus, the problem of sovereignty for Rousseau reduces itself to his meaning of the general will. That's all sovereignty could have meant for him. Rousseau defines sovereignty as 1, inalienable, 2, indivisible, and 3, unrepresentable. By inalienable, he meant sovereignty cannot be given away, and all legitimate sovereignty must rest upon the consent of the governed. Now he's back to his point of saying all the people have the right to be their own sovereign. And they alone have the right to give the authority to someone else to rule and be a sovereign. So it's inalienable. You can't give it all away, because the authority for being sovereign comes from the sovereign who's got the authority. It's kind of like saying there are no absolutes. Absolutely. Then he says it's indivisible. Sovereignty is the source of ultimate power in the civil society. Hence, it is indivisible. For Rousseau, the power is located in the general will. Well, how can the general will, which is the will of the totality, how can it be divided and still have general will? It become particular will. So it cannot become particular will, so it has to be general will. Therefore, it's indivisible. It must be of one will. But it's logical, only makes sense. Which he says is also indivisible and is a representation of the corporate whole. It is total unity. The implications of this concept are many, but one is outstanding of all. If all power is in the general will, and if it alone is sovereign, then the modern governments based upon check and balance or separation of power is impossible, because then you've divided the general will. And so democracy cannot have checks and balances, according to Rousseau. Because if the general will must be indivisible in order to have sovereignty, then check and balance and separation of powers is a division of a sovereignty. And that, he says, is not true democracy. That is interesting. As you can see, we got a lot of this stuff, part of it into our system, part of it not into our system. No wonder why our system was really a mess. I understand why. I forget who it was. I think it was Jefferson who wrote to John Adams. Was it, they died on the same day, did they not?
Yes, they did.
July 4th.
July 4th, 50 years after.
50 years. They were both supposed to speak at the same rally for July 4th. And they died within like 6 or 12 hours of each other. But in a letter just written that week before, Jefferson wrote to John Adams, and he said, "I knew that we had problems when we created our document, but I didn't know it was that bad." Because he'd seen what was coming. He could see the problems that were issuing. But you look and see what Rousseau has said, what Locke has said. We have somewhat of an eclectic type approach even in our Constitution, the ideologies that are coming in. And how can there be a general will of democracy and yet check and balance systems within it and have any kind of consistency? That was Rousseau's point. How can you have that? You can't. No separation of powers, or you've divided the sovereign. Of course, I think that's why our forefathers intended for there to be check and balances and separation of powers. They didn't intend for the government to ever be a sovereign. That's why they never used the word sovereign in their constitution, because they knew themselves they didn't claim any sovereignty. Because there was only one sovereign, God of heaven. But that was their Puritan influence. It sure wasn't their influence from outside the political arena of the Christian faith. And he said, thirdly, it is unrepresentative sovereignty. Rousseau desired a direct democracy. That is, where all the people voted in every decision, and not a representative democracy, which he held was not a true democracy. How can you vote for someone and have him vote for you? You just simply vote for yourself. Because this could lead to personal interest against the general will of the people. Well, I say he's got a good point there. It's very hard to figure out how you're going to have true democracy, which is the will of the people, when you got somebody voting for you who thinks this is what your will should be. That's a good point. It has to have some kind of a system to check and balance itself out. The problem still remains to be solved concerning freedom and contract. To be sovereign and to be in contract, and to be in a contract, this seems to be the problem of defining, as we said, A as A and not A at the same time. It is a logical contradiction. And unfortunately, Rousseau never solved the problem. That's all I can tell you. He just generalized it away. He acted as if it was not there. Because you cannot explain how a man remains sovereign, how a man remains free, and then enters into a contract. Because contracting absolutely restricts certain elements of his freedom. And Rousseau says, no, man is sovereign, and yet he grants sovereignty to those who rule over him. He cannot reconcile the two positions. It is impossible. So that is one of his major problems. Rousseau's theory of law. Rousseau defines law as what he calls direct action by the whole people, affecting all the people, which is, in essence, the same as stating the general will of the people. Rousseau wrote, and I quote, "But when the whole people decrees for the whole people, it is considering only itself." Did you catch that? It is considering only itself. And if a relation is then formed, it is between two aspects of the entire object, without there being any division of the whole. In that case, the matter about which the decree is made is like the decreeing will general. This This notion is what he calls, or he says, what I call law, unquote. The notion of the totality of the body choosing, acting, the general will, is the law. Whatever the majority demands is the general will of the people, must be the law of the people. The people then, in essence, are their own God. They are the sovereigns. They are the creators of law. That's all he's saying. This would be correct if sovereignty is the power inherent in the general will. Then law is its ability to act for its benefit of all. It is the law, the sovereignty of the general will, that breathes life into the social contract. What makes the social contract a living, powerful contract? It is that the sovereigns are granting it authority. They are granting their will as a whole to the whole of the all-inclusive people in the contract, to the totality of the contract and the individuals involved. And that will must be carried forth, no matter what. And so that's coming back to his point of sovereignty and law. Law is what the general will says is law. When the majority, and he would prefer to say that the majority would be everybody involved in voting, however, you're going to have some who do not, so if they are in the minority, they're going to be oppressed. The law is the will of the majority. That's all the law is. That's what democracy is. And he has said it quite well. And if the consent of the whole is to make this law, and they grant the sovereign ruler or rulers or government the authority to enforce that law, all of those who do not conform to that law will be forced to conform. You're back to the problem of authority and liberty. It's not a resolved problem. But that's what he says law is. Law is simply the will of the people. The people are their gods, their own gods, and they will form a body politic to rule over them, a legislative form of government, which is by direct consent. And it will be given authority and sovereignty, power, is what he means by that, not just authority, but true power, true sovereignty, the raw sheer power of force, to make all to conform to that general will. Thus, the general will is the creator of the law. And so he's trying to explain how a man is sovereign and contracts and gives sovereignty without denying sovereignty, and thereby creates law. That was a very simple thing. And he created law. And they created law. And that is the will of the people. That is the God of the people. And thus they are all in contract to live according to the will of the people. Still hasn't solved the problem of the fact that he's given up something to get into the contract. Hasn't resolved the problem of the majority versus the minority. Authority versus liberty. It has not been resolved. Rousseau admitted to what he believed was divine law as truth and stated that all justice comes from God. However, Rousseau states, and I quote, "All justice comes from God, who is its sole source,
But if we knew how to receive so high an inspiration, we should need neither governments nor laws, unquote. Now, Rousseau wasn't totally a pagan, so to some extent, with his background coming out of the Calvinistic traditions of Geneva, he says, well, yes, I agree. There must be some sole authority and law above all men. But if we knew how to get that law and how to receive it, we wouldn't need a government. And since we don't have it, we need government. And so therefore we need to determine how will we make law that men can live by. It must be the sovereigns granting together in unison in a contractual form the sovereign power of the government to legislate and create law by the will of the people. That's his answer. In essence, Rousseau divorced divine and natural law, because he rejected natural law also as being anything that could be established as a structure or plan for man to be governed by. Their theories, he divorces their theories and places himself much more closer to the political theory of the positive law theorist. And we're not going to talk about that now, but we'll get into it later. The problem of government usurpation and the remedies to check that usurpation. Rousseau says, without question, there's going to be times that the government is going to try to usurp its authority. And so he's going to tell you now, because you can see that's evident, if the general will of the people is to grant sovereignty to this governing body, and the governing body is part of the overall general will, and that general will has people who represent it or whatever, how are we going to do this governing authority? It's always possible that someone or a group of people will become a oppressive, authoritative group or individual, and thus usurp its authority. So there's always going to be the problem. Rousseau said, without question, every government is destined to die. Some just die slower than others. That's what he was trying to do, was keep his from dying so quickly. So he says, well, there's got to be some remedies to the problem that we're always going to have, that everything degenerates into tyranny. So how are we going to do that? What are the check and balance system? As it does happen, as we said, in most societies, the government begins to violate the social contract. That is, in Rousseau's terms, the government comes into conflict with the general will. This constant source of tension between the sovereign people and the government is reflected in Rousseau's entire political thought. That governments tend to act against the long-range interest of the people is a basic evil that tends to destroy the body politic. This results in two possible developments. The first he calls the transformation of a government, from which democracy transforms itself into an aristocracy, the governing party becoming the aristocracy, the elite who rule, and then into what he calls a royalty. Hence, a reverse approach to the problem is impossible. When it goes from democracy to an aristocracy and then into what he would call a monarchy, one man, a tyrant rule, divine right rule, he said it's impossible to reverse it. If it's impossible to reverse the flow, you know how you have to reverse it, don't you? You have revolution. That's logical. The second, he says, is the dissolution of the government. Government usurps its authority, and the contract is broken, and the people are freed. Thus, they have a right to revolt. I told you it was a logical conclusion. See, I was smart. I told you the answer before I even read it. Isn't it smart? The gradual dissolution of government itself by individuals seeking to control it must be brought under control. Hence, Rousseau is convinced that all political systems must die regardless of their forms. What we got to do is stop it. So the remedy to check the system. I dropped my own. The remedy to check the system, the check balance that he has to establish. Although, if you remember, we said, theoretically, check balance cannot work in a system in which you have the general will, when sovereignty is indivisible. But somehow he brings the checks balance system into this whole structure. The remedy of the check and balance system, how to stop this thing from going off or dying so quickly. He says there are two things to help slow down the process. The first is periodical assemblies, or what we call general assemblies, which we come together and we discuss the present form of government. It's always a good thing to discuss. And then you decide whether the present administration should be allowed to remain in power. He says, if we do that, surely we'll slow down the process of a government dying and eventually moving into some tyrannical form of government. And then he said, the second thing you need to do is when the government is, or when this body, this what they called a periodical assemblies, is assembled together, they could do two things. First, they could vote to dissolve the contract. He said we can do that by majority vote. Now, it's interesting that he says that, because in order to come into the contract, how many people had to vote? Everyone. Direct democracy. But he said to get out of the contract, it only takes a majority. That was interesting. That is a conflict in his thinking. Because what he is saying is, well, when it comes right down to it, comes down to the contract, you don't need a majority, you don't need anything but a majority to get out of it. But you needed a whole group. You had everybody had to contract into it. It took the totality of everyone to establish democracy, but only a majority to dissolve it. Now it's interesting that he could come up with such a position when he was so avid in trying to establish a direct democracy. Now, you must remember, too, two, he said, the other thing we can do is you can appoint a new magistrate to conduct the government until the next meeting. If you couldn't resolve the problem throughout the present, if you couldn't come up with a new way to administrate it, simply reform it by a temporary government until you come back together the next time and decide what you want to do. That was his two answers. And that's the only answers he had to the problems of stopping this government from degenerating into a tyranny. He had no other answers. Now, he didn't answer the problems. And he would probably be the first willing to admit, when the problems of authority and liberty come into question, he just dances around them and goes right on, just as if they weren't there. It's kind of like the guy who's playing football. He is given, you know, the backfield's in motion. They blow the whistle, they throw him the ball, and he just keeps on running because he said it's irrelevant to me. Now, interestingly enough, you've got to remember all these political theorists are dealing in theoretical realms. They're dealing with theories of government. How these things work when they're put in place is totally different than the way that they're supposed to work on paper. Interestingly enough, they just seem to never line up appropriately. But Rousseau's position, without question, is a major influence in history. One, it was a major influence in the French Revolution, in which the French revolted in the aristocracy and they overthrew it and they established from that day forth a socialism that came into effect. They still live in that socialism today. Secondly, without question, Rousseau's position and theoretical views of politics had an influence in American government. It had an influence in the area of contract between the king and the colonies, and that they felt justified in a revolt when the king broke the contract and usurped his authority, stepped out of bounds of what the contract. And you remember, they all came here with a contract, with a charter, and they were all, as Jack said, they were land grant colonies. So, you know, they were separated under different contracts, and the way that things were to be run. When he breaks it, they had a right to remove. And that was Rousseau's influence, even during that time period, in his writings that were going on. Not unlike John Locke, though, or John Stuart Mill. And you must also remember that Rousseau is the founding father, in one sense, in this structure of the general will, of George Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel. And Hegel who established the new system of logic, which is called the dialectic, which is the Greek word for logic. The dialectic combined it with Schopenhauer's materialism, and you had dialectical materialism, which became the very essence of Karl Marx's Communist Manifesto. So Rousseau is, in one sense, the father of the French Revolution. He has great inroads, influences in the American Revolution. No one can deny that. I don't think it is as immediate and as direct as it was in the French Revolution. I think there was only overtures there. And he had a direct influence in the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Through Hegel's study of his political views. As a result, you might say Rousseau ruled the 18th and 19th centuries in his views of political philosophy. Very influential individual with glaring contradictions, but appealing. And it's a popular position. It's appealing to the natural man to say that thou art sovereign and thou can remain sovereign and yet have a government that is sovereign but yet answerable to you. That sounds good, but it does not work. It always breaks down because neither are sovereign. Neither are sovereign. And so this is what you're looking at with these people. All of these theorists who are writing, their books are in circulation. Thomas Paine, who was involved in our revolution, was greatly influenced by Rousseau and his thinking, along with Mill influence and John Locke's influence. The influence of the secularists were there. We'll not deny that. We dare not deny that. But it was an infusion with Christianity. And it's absolutely set up inherent problems in our system of government. And we still to this day have that problem. We have seen, you know, and that's interesting. I think if we knew, and I'm sure we don't know, but I think it would be interesting to find out how many revolutions the American government has financed across the world. I know in some of these countries they finance revolutions through the CIA. I wonder how many, and you know, but we condemn revolutions. We condemn certain revolutions and then we don't condemn certain revolutions. We condemn only those that are not self-serving to our government. How far have we bought into Rousseau's thinking? Is it in the best interest of who? We have seen a distortion. We've seen an eclectic approach to political views in our day and age. We've seen Rousseau's philosophy in areas. We've heard this argument, and we've seen all this stuff go through that Rousseau's talking about. You're seeing the democracy and power. They came together and they granted sovereignty, and now those who were to govern have become their own sovereign. And now they don't want to give it up. And now they've become tyrannical. They become oppressive. And now they become what you call a totalitarian government or regime. It always degenerates to some form of totalitarianism. And eventually, that totalitarianism, without question, is a tyrannical position. And then it degenerates into anarchy, because eventually the people will say no more, and you have a revolt and you have anarchy, and you're no better position than you are when you started. The problem is they have no standard. That's what you've got to understand. Locke did not have a standard of law. Mill did not have a standard of law, and Rousseau had no standard of law but their own sovereign will. The rights and the will of the people. The rights and the rule of the majority. And they never could resolve the problem of tyranny. Because tyranny, power and authority is in the hands of man, is an ultimate result. you're always going to end up with tyranny in some form or another. When man is governed by the laws of God, it will not end up in tyranny. It cannot. Because both those who rule, those who judge, those who represent, and those who live, all live under one just system of law. One king who is sovereign, but who always is just by his nature. And he never judges you outside of his law, but according to his law. That is the only answer. There is no other answer. You can spend as much time as you want going through all of these different political theorists. You can spend as much time as you want to try to Christianize our Constitution and all the other things that went into our system. You will not resolve the problem until you have first established the ultimate standard by which men must live. And that standard must be the law of God. Until you've done that, you will end up eventually where we are at presently today. We will always come back to this point. That's why I've said to you over and over and over again, we cannot be involved in revolutions unless those are for the advancing of the kingdom of God and they are led by godly men who are going to build the kingdom of God. Any revolution that is not going to advance the kingdom of God, and by that I don't think it's really called a true revolution in the terms of Rousseau. That's right, it'd be a reformation. And sometimes reformations do not have to be a revolution, that is to say, to pick up the gun. They can be reformations and restorations and reconstructions. But anything that is not of the kingdom of God is not an option for the children of the kingdom. And that point must be made. I will not participate in something that is ungodly. I have seen in third world countries what happens when they have revolution. They get a worse government than they had. Because when evil tries to overthrow evil, it only gives itself a larger scale to execute its evil and more authority to do it with. We did not see in our forefathers the desire to replace one form of evil government with another. They still had the abounding influence of the Puritans and their theology with them. It is without question that all the things that they wrote, the reason why the word sovereign did not come up in their documents, is because they knew there was but one sovereign, the God of heaven. And there could be but one law, His law. And all their laws must coincide with His laws. They understood that. But they didn't define it. And since they didn't write it in and define it, because they just couldn't conceive of a government living outside of that ideology, when you get to the third or fourth generation, the Puritanism died. And the democracy took root. And at that point, we started down the primrose path to destruction. And we're still heading that way. It will only be a movement of God to revival, to reformation of the people that will stop this country for destruction. Because as all countries go, and I think Rousseau is right, all but one, the one that follows the law of God will never see destruction. But all countries that are made of men, who are ruled by men, men who rule by their own law, they eventually must die. And America is no exception. And the reason why she must die is because she has turned against God, and God says, the nation and the people that turn their back upon me, I will cast into hell. You're not going to violate God's rule and live to tell about it. And so we need to understand the reason for viewing these men. We started with Plato. We went to Hobbes. We've looked at Locke. We've looked at John Stuart Mill and Rousseau. The reasons for viewing these men is to see In man there is no answer. There is no answer. There cannot be answer in men. There is only one place that we can find the answer. And that is in the Word of the living God. This is the law by which all men and nations can be established. And we need to realize that. All right. If you have any questions,